I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Well, today our guest is Dr. Russell Graham, research forester at the USDA Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station in Moscow, Idaho. And we'll be talking about forest fires in Idaho from the Big Burn in 1910 to fires on through up to 2007. This is a real important topic.
Absolutely. We've been seeing plenty of forest fires in the news and around Idaho in the last 3-4 years.
Absolutely. Well, anyone who lives in Idaho is well aware of fires and the dangers that are associated with it. This couldn't be a more appropriate topic this time of year when that's always on our mind. Before we dig into that, Peter, why don't you give us some nature news?
We got to get some nature news. We've got an elderly couple in Torquay, England, and they have beaten the odds of one, and there, I counted them, 36 zeros after the one.
Okay, so that's low odds. One in a billion, one in a trillion, one in a quadrillion. This is one in an undecillion. That's a word.
Undecillion.
That's
undecillion.
One followed by 36 zeros.
36 zeros. Okay. They got a carton of eggs, 12 eggs. Each egg was a double yolk.
Get out.
So every egg they cracked open in a carton of eggs was a double yolk.
Huh.
I would rather beat the odds on something other than a carton full of double yolks.
Well, so what did they win for their great luck? Extra yolk.
Extra yolk. some great tasting omelets, I imagine. So the double yolks usually happen with younger hens. It's one of their first laying cycle, and, you know, mistakes happen. So I don't know if it came from one clutch, if it came from multiple young hens.
Right. So if you have a dozen eggs in your carton, presumably they're not all coming from the same hen. Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. So something's in the water there.
Something's in the water, and it resulted in 36 zeros behind that one.
So a very improbable occurrence of getting 12
double yolk eggs in one carton.
Huh. Well, here's hoping that you at least get two in a carton.
Well, I would be happy with one.
Well, okay, thanks. Thanks a lot. Okay, so trivia time. We like to do a little trivia at the top of the show. Today, we're going to be talking about fire. So the question, naturally, is about fire management. When did fire management begin in the Western United States?
And this is different from fire suppression. This is management.
This is managing fires. When did it all begin? You're going to hear the answer to that question and so much more as we talk about fires in Idaho right after this break.
KISU works hard to ensure the reliability of our FM signal, but occasionally, seasonal weather or equipment failures cause us to go off the air. Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome Dr. Russell Graham. He's a research forester who works for the USDA, the Forest Service, Rocky Mountain Research Station in northern Idaho in Moscow. So first off, thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you know, forest fires are a big topic in our region. I guess I wanted to ask first off about your job and how you got into forestry and studying fires.
Boy Scouts of America in 1966.
I've heard many stories that start that way. Go ahead.
I got a forestry merit badge, and I started with the Forest Service that summer.
Wow.
The only employer I've ever had. I worked in National Forest Systems for 10 years in the Black Hills in northern Idaho over in the Bitterroot and came for research in 1975 and been here in Moscow for that time studying all aspects of forestry. including how to grow trees, how the soils interact with trees, and more recently looking at some big landscape processes and really understanding fire and how it burns trees. I'm a research silviculturist. I learn and study and culture trees.
So, you know, before we start talking about fires in forest systems, could you give us just a quick outline of what kind of forest systems exist in Idaho? Because it's such a big state.
Well, that's a very good question. I think that Idaho is one of the most lucky states in the West, as our forest, and which I'll add woodlands to it, transitions from very down there in the southern Idaho, which is very sparse forests, all the way up to central Idaho, and we get into the area around Sun Valley. We get into the high elevation peaks with lodgepole pine. Up down around Boise, we have a lot of big ponderosa pine forests. We move north, and we get to some more ponderosa pine forests up around McCall, and a whole bunch of lodgepole pine forests. And finally, we get up here into northern Idaho, which we have the moist forests. They are only second to some of the west side forests on the west side of the Continental Divide, of growing large trees, predominantly our Idaho state tree, western white pine. These forests are very magnificent with, you know, and historically they had like 200-foot tall trees, you know, 30, 40 inches in diameter. Very lush forests, a home to grizzly bears, produce water for the Columbia River, and of course some of the magnificent elk herds.
You know, what I'm finding out about Idaho, I've been here for 5 years, it really is a jigsaw puzzle of some amazing habitats and environments. With this puzzle, are you looking at different types of forest fires, or because the fuel load is probably going to be different depending on the different regions that you're at. So when you look at forest fires throughout Idaho, are there different types of fires?
Oh, yes, there is, very much so. In the ponderosa pine forest are the classic underburns that historically burned on very frequent intervals of maybe 10, 15 to 20 years and leaving this open cathedral of ponderosa pine forest. Then you move into the lodgepole pine forest, or sometimes called the coal forest. These are predominantly historically were stand replacing fires, it's typified by the 1988 fires of Yellowstone. Remember that when those fires burned in Yellowstone, people said, well, why don't you just put them out? There was so much fire in Yellowstone, and you go back and look at it now, it is green. The lodgepole pine forests are these historically were severe stand replacing fires. Then you move into the moist forests, and we talk about a mixed severity fire. In other words, many times the Forest Service, one of my colleagues called them, why bother fires? The fires will start maybe in the spring and April and have these little fires burning around. And when we start talking about the big burn in 1910, some of those little fires may be burned for months. Sometimes they blow up into major fires. So again, the dry forest, the cold forest, and the moist forest all historically have different fire regimes, and also they have different ways of recycling their nutrients and their organic matter, therefore also.
Yeah, I find this a fascinating topic. Fires are a natural phenomena, of course, and forests, the plant life and animals have adapted to deal with and maybe even benefit from occasional fires. How is our understanding, I guess, of how those ecosystems, how they manage with fire and how fire is part of the processes that lead to the ecosystems that we see?
Well, that's sort of that typifies some of the misunderstandings about fires. When we look at the ponderosa pine fires, yes, the low undersurface non-lethal fires burned up the needles, cleaned the forest floor, and recycled the organic matter and stimulated nutrients, et cetera, et cetera. Then you move into the northern Idaho forest, instead of having fire as the recycling agent, organisms, decomposition takes over as the major recycling agent of material. So instead of having fire as being the oxidation agent, like in the ponderous pine, we have rotting organisms in the soils recycling material. So again, each system has a different way of recycling their nutrients, recycling their organic matter. And so fire is part of the system and a main contributor in the ponderosa pine systems, a main stand replacing in the cold forest, and a mixed severity and occasionally large stand replacing fires in the moist systems.
You mentioned earlier about the 1910 fire, and it sounds like it's kind of started off as a slow burner. You had little pockets here and there. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about this fire and really why it's important for Idaho and the long-term effects of that fire?
Again, when we look at Idaho and the splendid resources we have, one of the major resources that supported the economies of Idaho, of northern Idaho, and really helped build Chicago, Minneapolis, and the cities to the east was the large bounty of western white pine and western larch and Douglas fir trees in northern Idaho. In the late 1800s, there was the largest sawmill in the world occurred in Potlatch, Idaho, producing millions and billions of board feet for construction that went to the east towards Minneapolis and Chicago on railroad cars. So again, these forests were very magnificent, led to really strengthen the economies of Spokane, of Coeur d'Alene, of Missoula, all the way over to Seattle. And like I say, the largest sawmill in the world was in Potlatch, Idaho, with a whole another 72 sawmills growing in or cutting logs in Idaho. And the other thing that was going on at the turn of the century was coming across the Bitterroot Divides. That's the divide between Idaho and Montana. There was the Northern Pacific Railroad, Northern Railroad, and the Milwaukee Railroad that crossed the Bitterroots. These trains were all, of course, steam-powered at that time, and wood was their number one fuel that they used when they crossed these mountains. So needless to say, you could understand how this fire-burning locomotive crossing the mountains of the Bitterroot was producing a lot of sparks and everything that would start fires. In 1910, the winter of 1910 was quite moist. We have droughts, especially in our forests, and they are accustomed to it. So in 1910, starting in April through about August 19th, there was about 1,700 fires burning. And these fires sort of just mushed around. And one commentator on the fire says, we've get through these before, but if we don't get up a loose blow. And so August 20th and 21st, the dry winds out of the Palouse blew towards northern Idaho. And in basically 2 days' time, 3.1 million acres burned.
Wow. In 2 days?
Yeah, like I say, it was 1,700 fires. So it wasn't one start. There was just a whole bunch of them that came together in all directions. The major river that flows east to west across Idaho, the River of No Return, where the Salmon River leaves Salmon in Idaho and heads for Riggins, pretty much any place north of that, all the way to the Canadian border, over to Glacier Park, over into eastern Washington, there was fires burning during that period. And like I say, they really took off then on August 20th and 21st.
how did they get put out, and what was the result after that fire?
Humans have tried to put out fires for years, but usually it's nature who does it. By the end of August, the snow started coming and started putting the fires out. Now, there's two outcomes that are really interesting for the 1910 fires. One is ecological, but the other one is political. And if you recall from your history of the Forest Service was established in 1900 by Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt. And so the 1910 fire came along and very quickly discovered the state of Idaho or other states do not have the resources or the money to take on these major fires. So therefore, the 1910 fires really gave the Forest Service a reason to be in, and that reason to exist was to suppress wildfires.
So with this mandate of suppression, we've kind of moved away from that, and this is part of the trivia question, so we're not going to answer it yet. But we've moved towards kind of a management of force and fire. So what's the difference between suppression and management? But don't answer the trivia question.
Sort of two things that really come to my mind when I think about those. In the 1910 fire, again, we had Pulaski in fame. He was burned over in a tunnel. The town of Taft, Montana, totally destroyed. So fire was really something to fear. And then we came along with the movie of Bambi, that the fire was something to really fear. And especially, like I say, in northern Idaho, when the fires are really a lot of stand replacing fires, and also in lodgepole pine systems, like I mentioned at Yellowstone, these fires can be very horrific. The suppression policy was we worked hard to suppress every fire by 10 o'clock. We had lookouts, and another really interesting tale is to look at all of the lookouts. There's a good history of them across the state of Idaho. Roads and road construction, telephone lines, all of the infrastructure to suppress fires. So smoke jumpers really thrived on this two-manner to suppress a fire very quickly before it got large. That was sort of the mandate. Quickly, we discovered that, especially in some of our wilderness areas, they weren't being regenerated. The trees were getting old. They were getting decadent. Some of the wildlife that really depended on young growth and everything was not there because of the lack of fires that used to regenerate and rejuvenate. So in the Whitecap Wilderness area over in the Selway Bitterroot in mid-1970s, so this is the first one where instead of suppressing the fire, then the fire was managed and the fire was herded as it tried to move through the landscape. Instead of suppressing it, build a little bit of fire line here, a little bit of fire line there. So the fire was actually managed. From that genesis, it really turned out to be sort of the art of managing fires.
Right. So what you're explaining is a way of controlling the pathway that the fire is going to consume timber and fuels, and through creating fire breaks and maybe even encouraging the fire to go one way versus another. You can manage it that way. Is that the approach?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, now I'm going to morph into the art of burning out and burning fuels in advance of a fire, controlling and managing the fire with proper and informed fire use during a fire episode. The other one is preparing fuel. What do you want left after the fire burns becomes most important.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach. You know, I always wonder, obviously, as urbanization expands into forested areas or areas that are maybe more prone to burn, how can citizens best protect their assets but also be a help to the Forest Service management?
In 2007 is a good example more managing a fire than suppressing a fire. In Warm Lake in 2007 is such a good example. The fire in that area burned from basically Idaho City all the way to Darby, Montana, hitting and missing. Not one continuous fire, but very close to it. And the best example of a homes and area being ready for such a fire was the area around Warm Lake. Warm Lake is straight east of Cascade, Idaho. And it's burned into one of those combination of a mixed lodgepole pine, cold forest, along with some ponderosa pine forest. I think there was around 40-some homes around Warm Lake, which they did an excellent job of preparing, clearing the brush, burning the slash before the fire and also during the fire. The Forest Service did an admirable case of doing some prescribed fires earlier in the year. So the area around Warm Lake was very prepared. Like I say, it was when a fire burns, what do you want left? You want some trees left? You want your houses left? You want some cabins left? So again, that was a very good case in point in Idaho of that success story.
So here at Zoo Idaho, we talk a little bit about FireWise gardens and FireWise homes. And it really is reducing the fuel load for that fire as you approach a house. And that's what these guys did.
Yes. The most important zone around your house is about 100 feet, this home ignition zone. If you keep this relatively low severity fires, but most importantly, too, make sure your house doesn't have combustible material right down to the ground. Make sure there's not branches or shrubs or anything combustible up against the house. A very interesting one, too, is the vents on the end of your house. In these ponderosa pine forests, you get needles stuck in those vents on the end of your house. You get needles hanging in the troughs of your rain gutters or even the trough of your house. Those are very good ignition sources. Again, in some of the major fires in the ponderosa pine system, they produce tremendous amount of embers. And those embers can enter into your attic through those vents on the end of your house and start burning your house down from the inside out. So again, that preparedness way before the hand, and especially that 100 feet of ignition zone around your house becomes the most important. And again, just like managing a fire in the outside in the wildlands, what you want to have that fire burn when it burns around your house becomes so important.
This is really good advice. Defensible space is something we preach a lot around in our part of the world because it's unfortunately it's part of living in beautiful places. Fire is a reality, and we have to be ready for it. We started off the program with a question about management. When did fire management begin, really, in Western United States? Dr. Graham, could you tell us?
I think the transformation started in about 1972-73.
Wow.
And the realization that fires, the suppression for years, was ineffective. And in fact, probably, and especially the ponderosa pine systems, the fires used to frequently burn through the ponderosa pine systems and clear out the small trees and the brush. And those suppression activities over the years, and very noticeable in the last few years, over the last 10 or 15 years, especially in the drier parts of the western United States, Colorado, Arizona, some of New Mexico, when the suppression of those fires let all the small seedlings and saplings grow, now when they do burn, instead of having a nice benign fire, those saplings and small shrubs move the fire into the crowns and have some major crown fires. As climate is changing, it's getting drier, we have more fuels, especially in the ponderosa pine systems, and they are burning much with higher severity and larger, more intense fires. Even in northern Idaho, we again had extremely dry conditions, had a very large fire season for us in the history. But again, with all of our roads and the early detection system, the fires were nowhere even close to turning into a 1910. So again, but the people around the houses that were affected by those fires in northern Idaho, still that 100-foot zone becomes very important.
All right. We want to thank you, Dr. Russell Graham, for joining us today. And to learn more about his work and forest fires in general, please visit the Rocky Mountain Research Station website at www.fs.fed.us/RMRS/. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at kisu.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock, and please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.